Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. We're here the start of the second week of August. I want to thank you for joining me this week. First show this August. And July was kind of a wet month. It was over 10 inches of rain, which I don't think was a record for July, but certainly wetter than normal. And then it seemed like the calendar turned to August and we had some nice weather over the last week or so, and a little bit of rain in there as well, but some sunny days, and was able to get out. My family's in town, and parents and brother, and we're able to get out berry picking, pick some mountain blueberries and some other blueberries as well as huckleberries. So a nice time of year for getting out and picking those. Noticing that the birds seem to be a lot quieter these days. I think there's a few begging juveniles around, but definitely not much territorial singing going on. I expect it's probably going to be next month, I guess, September, when some of the southbound migrants that winter here will come in. I've noticed in the past the song sparrows are, they start singing again a little bit then, and I see some skirmishes, and I think it's birds arguing a little bit over their wintering territories. So hopefully you've been getting out and seeing. I think I've noticed some mixed flocks of warblers and so forth starting to form, and haven't really noticed a lot of obvious migration other than the shorebirds down at the beach. Got a report of some 5 wandering paddlers out at Halibut Point Rec. Didn't get to see those myself, but was down there a couple days later and saw 5 spotted sandpipers, which is kind of fun. Hadn't seen those in a while. And so it's been just a trickle of things. You know, I think migration's going to pick up here as the month goes on and we head into September. And I think that's kind of our peak migration is in September. So I want to thank folks that have taken the time to share some of those observations with me and others as well. If you're interested in birds in particular, you can get on sitkanature.org, and there's a link there for joining the Sitka Birds email list. Or if you prefer to use Facebook, there's a Sitka Birds group on Facebook. You can get on there, and folks have been posting pictures and asking questions about what they've been seeing at their feeders. And so it's kind of a fun way to interact with others that are interested in birds around Sitka. Also, if you just have questions about other things or don't feel like posting anything to a group, I'd be happy to hear from you via email, sitkanature@gmail.com. Ask any questions or things you're interested in, things you've observed and want to share. I always appreciate hearing about what other people are seeing. You know, it's impossible to get out there and see everything on your own, and there's always stuff going on. So it's kind of fun to get out there and or hear about what other people are seeing while they're out there, I guess I should say. So that's great. And also, if you're interested in prior shows, you can get on sitkanature.org/raven, find links to past shows there. Or you can go to Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page, and I generally will post a link to when I post the link of the recording, I'll post that on the Facebook group, and as well as some other blog posts that I do that I think might be of more general interest. This week, I have actually a guest in the studio with me. I didn't pre-record this conversation, but my brother Jonathan has been visiting for the last almost a week now. Like me, he grew up here and currently lives in the Seattle area, which is similar climate-wise, a little warmer. I think he appreciates the warmth and the sun there. And he said when he was getting ready to come up, he looked at the forecast, and it was for the 7 days that he was supposed to be here. It was like rain, rain, rain. He's like, oh, that's why I live in Seattle.
So high of 60, high of 62, high of 59.
High of 60s. And I guess what's it been in Seattle this summer? In the 70s and 80s maybe even?
Yeah, I mean, it's normal for it to be in the fairly normal for it to be in the low 80s, and there's often streaks of in the 90s and stuff. Earlier in the summer, we had a couple of weeks in the 90s. People were complaining about that a little bit, too hot, but the lower 80s people like a little better.
Well, and that's where I tend to think of Seattle. People ask, well, what's the weather like in Sitka? And I'm like, well, it's like Seattle, but 10 degrees cooler, and maybe it's closer to 15. I suppose Seattle area probably depends a lot whether you're right on the water or up a little bit inland.
Yeah, definitely. And like if you go up closer to the Cascades, the weather gets much more similar to here, although still warmer, but like precipitation wise and stuff like that, North Bend gets similar amount of rain as here, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, out on the Olympic Peninsula, it's a little cooler than Seattle. It's a little more heavy maritime influence. So yeah, it's been fun to have him here. We got out and like I said, we went berry picking one day, and today we went for a hike with my kids and saw some bear tracks and trails and other sign. And I thought it'd be fun to talk to him a little bit about one of the things that he's done in the last, I don't know, 10 years or so. It seems like you've been interested in tracking, maybe even a little longer. I don't know.
I mean, I got interested longer ago than that, but I didn't really feel like I was able to start learning it very well until more recently. I mean, like 8 years ago.
Yeah.
When I was taking classes and stuff, instead of, like, it was hard for me when I just tried to read books about it and stuff, mm-hmm. and didn't have anybody around that knew any of that stuff. So yeah, once I was around other people who knew tracking, it was a lot easier for me to start feeling comfortable learning, instead of just like going on a hike and all I saw was dog tracks and I didn't know they were dog tracks, even though it should have been probably pretty obvious. But
yeah, well, so tracking is like one of the, I mean, birding is often, you can look at books and you, but it's so much easier to learn your birds when you go with somebody who knows and they can ask you sort of directing questions. But and like we were out today and my son Connor, he's like, oh, there's a three-legged dog, I think he said, up here or something. I don't know why he thought it was a three-legged dog, but he says, there's a dog track. And so you came up and you were behind him and you looked down and you're like, that's not a dog track. Are you sure that's a dog track? And why do you think that's a dog track? And so he came back and looked at it and he's like, well, I guess the other thing it could be was a land otter. It's too big for anything. And so this was sort of him, you know, like in his mind, if you hadn't been there to sort of ask him that question, he would have been right. That would have been a dog track, and there would have never been any doubt in his mind that it was a dog track. So it's helpful to have somebody there that, not necessarily to tell you what it is. Sometimes that can be helpful, but to just ask some questions. Maybe they know what it is. Maybe they don't. Maybe they know what it's not. And sometimes that's just as valuable. And so they ask some questions, and if they do know what it is and what they're looking at, they can sort of ask questions in a directing way. Like some species of birds, for example, behavior is pretty important. Like when I saw the spotted sandpipers, I didn't see them very well, but I saw one fly, and they have a very distinctive flight pattern of this kind of and then glide, and this kind of this really fast wing beat and then glide. And no other shorebirds do that. And there's another very similar looking shorebird to the spotted sandpiper that doesn't do that, but otherwise they look pretty similar. And in a track, you know, it's not always, I you know, you asked him, one of the questions I heard you ask him about was, I can't remember how the progression exactly, but he thought, well, it could be a martin, I guess, but it'd be a really big martin. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like you asked him something about how martin feet look.
I asked him about the fur, like if their feet were furry or not. I'm not actually certain what kind of track that was. I didn't look that close at it and think about it that much. And I don't run into martin tracks very often either. So it might have been, but, also like it could have been a mink potentially, or an otter. And one of the characteristics to think about is like how furry a foot is, and for species that are similar like those ones, some of the species have much furrier feet than others, and I think martin in particular have pretty furry feet, so that can be something to look for when you're looking at the track, to help distinguish that from something else. So
yeah, and I guess it seems like one of the important things to start with is, and this is something that Connor's like, oh, there's a deer track. And I was like, well, how do you know it's a deer track? And it's a deer track. And he goes, because it looks like an ungulate, and that's the only thing that would be here. You know, so you, mm-hmm. you narrow it down by knowing what your candidates are to start with. We're not going to see a kudu track here in Southeast Alaska, for example.
Yeah, I would say that's one of the most important skills or knowledge bases to have if you're wanting to do tracking, as far as being able to recognize track and sign, is to know just what's around. Like if you go out and I did a tracking evaluation when I was just first getting into tracking, and basically it was just a quiz. You know, we were around under a bridge by a river and in California, and like the people who knew what they're doing went and circled different tracks and sign and put little questions on them, and then we went around and tried to answer them, and then after everybody had a chance, we went around and they told us what they were and explained why, or let us ask questions or things like that. And I felt like just knowing like, oh, okay, well, clearly that's a small animal. And beforehand, I had researched like, what are the animals in this area? I'm going to be like, okay, the small animals, like I could tell it was a rodent track because I'd learned a little bit about how to tell apart rodent tracks from other animals. And then so small rodents, there was like a ground squirrel and a chipmunk and, you know, a deer mouse or something were the options. I don't remember exactly, but so if you can narrow it down to that, then like, that's a lot easier than if you're just like, I don't know, like could be anything, right?
Yeah.
So knowing what's there, having a sort of a master list for what species are in your area and kind of having an idea of how big they are and, what they're, where they live, like, If you're seeing mustelid tracks like a marten or a mink, if you're up on top of a mountain versus you're right next to a creek, you know, that's going to inform what you might think it is. Like, you know, mink like to hang out near creeks and eat fish and stuff like that. Martens tend to be, I think around here they probably may be lower elevation, but or can be lower elevation, but they like to hang up in the mountains too.
They go, they vary. Like yeah. You see them, people running trap lines trap them at low elevations.
Yeah. But a mink probably is less likely to be on top of a mountain, for instance, you know? So like I found a mustelid track on top of the Middle Sister several years ago. And it's like, okay, that's probably a marten because it's probably not going to be a
was that the hike we went up there and like there was berry scat
there was like a salmon full of berries filled with salmon berries and then there was another one that had herring bones in it
that was almost like animal. it was a couple on the same place on the like the very top of the hill
on a rock on the top of the mountain it was on top of the rock on top of the mountain like they like to a lot of animals like to do signpost sort of things where they leave things in obvious places to I think it can vary why depending on what species, but to kind of, you know, mark their area or let other animals know they're around or whatever.
Kind of the little communications depot, I guess. You know, it's funny. We're talking about sign and tracks, and maybe we should sort of define what those are in general here in a moment. But because one of the things I remember as a kid is like dad would go hunting and mom would ask him about it and he'd say, oh, well, we didn't even see any sign or there was lots of sign, but we didn't see any deer. And I probably wasn't very old, under 10 at the time, I'm sure. And I would hear that. And like in my mind, that meant that there were actual, like somebody posted a sign and it says deer. And I'm like, that's weird. I wonder why, you know, and I didn't understand exactly what he was talking about. And I think he was probably mostly talking about droppings and tracks, you know, like the footprints. And so those are the things that probably people most think of, but that's not all we're talking about when we speak about tracks and sign more generally.
No. Yeah. So there's also, those are often the main things that people look for is tracks and scat. Those are often the most common sorts of things to find, but, and around here, tracks is kind of actually a hard location a lot of times for finding tracks because there's not a lot of places where there's nice substrate, where like other places you can go down to the river and there are nice sandbars and stuff. You can find a lot of good tracks there. Here, it's a little bit more limited. So it's really good to be aware of other kinds of sign that are around. So like today we saw trees that bears had been rubbing on and biting and scratching and stuff like that. So that's a really neat thing to look for around here. Deer will also rub on trees. And like, I didn't know that until a few years ago when I was, you know, starting to get into tracking and stuff. And I was like, oh, I've never seen that where I grew up, you know, and we spent a fair amount of time outside and hiking around and stuff like that. And, you know, deer all over the place. And so it's like, I wonder if that happens and I just didn't notice it or if they don't do that up there. And then so after I learned that and came back up, it's like, oh, I'm going to look out for that kind of thing. And sure enough, it's around, you know, they do it here too. It's just like something that if you don't know to look for it, it's easy to miss.
And so the rubbing for deer is often their antlers, the males, like when they're shedding the velvet. and in the rut maybe?
Yeah, it's a marking behavior. They can rub the velvet off, and then they also will just mark often at the base of trees in sort of well-traveled areas. And I think there's scent that kind of gets rubbed on there along with that. I suspect there's a visual component of like the where the bark is scraped off, you know, you get a brighter color there. So that's probably part of that too. And I don't know all the details about how what that's communicating as far as like whether that's mostly sort of a dominance between males or if it also is like attracting the females in there or what. I'm not really sure, but I'm sure that's probably known information. But
yeah, I guess I had the impression that part of what was going on is also just a polishing of their antlers. But I don't, you know,
I think that can be. I mean, I think they do that, but that's I think they also mark aside from
that. Yeah. And so around here, what I've noticed is in the muskegs, a lot of times is the smaller pines get beat up pretty bad sometimes. And some and there will be several maybe in an area.
Yeah.
Also, they seem to like to use all. I guess partly it's the smaller diameter trees, and I'm not sure whether they're limited to it's limited to those trees or that's just happens to be where I've noticed it. There's no end of things that I haven't happened to notice, even if they're obvious sometimes. But alders and stuff, and alders have that nice, I mean, they turn bright red after they've been.
Yeah.
And even, you know, a season later, you can see the scars.
Oh, yeah,
the
you
bark,
can see it for years later. A lot of times it's often becomes less obvious as far as the brightness and color goes, but you can see them from pretty old. And they will often use the same trees over year after year because just presumably the location or whatever is a good spot. But
we have tracks, we have scat or droppings, territorial sign markings, which for deer includes these rubs. For other animals, I suppose there's like scratching posts, in some places cats, I guess, maybe do that. Bears seem to do that some.
Yeah, and I don't know, like, it's interesting. I've read a bit about, like, with brown bears, they definitely will mark on trees and rub on them and scratch them and bite them. And from what I've read, it's not a territorial marking behavior in the way that we often think of as far as like, oh, this bear has this territory and like it defends that territory against other bears. It is more, from what I've read, more of a communication thing where it's like, well, they don't really want to run into each other, right? Because it's safer to not get into fights and stuff like that. So it is sort of a marking behavior of like, oh, yeah, okay, I can smell like this other bear there. And that was pretty recent, or that was a long time ago, so I probably don't have to worry about it or whatever. And areas where there's higher bear density and more bear usage, so like around salmon rivers, you get more of those marking behaviors. And areas where there's less density, you get less of it. But the bears can use the same area. Different bears can use the same area, and they're not necessarily defending like an area against other bears. It's just they want to avoid each other.
Helps them play nice together, so to speak.
Right.
That makes sense. And then so I guess other things that, you know, and we're still talking kind of mammals here, larger mammals, like feeding sign, sort of, I guess there's kind of different sorts of feeding sign, both sort of what we might call ephemeral feeding sign, things like herbs and things that isn't, it, like it's there, but it doesn't last for a long time. And then the sort of like habitual feeding sign of some shrubs, for example, that are just like hit every year, I guess. And I suppose that for around here is most often deer, but I guess other animals are probably eating stuff too. Maybe they're mostly eating herbaceous stuff. Like I've seen, I watched a little, I'm not sure whether it was a vole or a mouse. I didn't get a good look at it, but, it was clipping grass up on Harbor Mountain one year. And when I saw it, then I saw the little stalk of the grass left. And I guess, I mean, I suppose it's not just like one thing or another, because they're also the habitual runs. They aren't really tracks, but they're habitual, like the deer path.
The voles do that. Yeah. And you can look in the muskegs or up in the alpine, like, few years ago we were up on Bear Mountain and that year was really a heavy vol year, it seemed mm-hmm. like, and the just really thick vol trails through the heather. And like, we, I think I saw several voles just like running through, running yeah. past, which, you know, often I don't see that, but that year I did. And yeah, and there probably you get some of that browse on the shrub, like the short shrubs and stuff mm-hmm. will be from voles and stuff too, because they clip the vegetation and eat that and stuff. So smaller rodents can do that.
And so they'll be active. The voles up high will be active in the winter underneath the snow, as mm-hmm. I understand it. So they're not really hibernating. And so sometime in the springtime, I guess you can see that, maybe, is it latrines that you sometimes
yeah,
find?
Sometimes there will be just like a huge wadge of vole scat and like just sitting in a pile in the
yeah
in the meadow or whatever. You're like, that's kind of weird. Like, and often it'll be kind of a tube shaped sort of thing, and I think that's just because like they shove out a clearing and underneath the snow and then just like pack it all in there and
yeah,
and then the snow melts away and it just looks like this tube of vole poop. So
one of the, and that, I guess that reminds, so like if you were just to run into this and you'd be like, well, how does this happen? It seems like an important skill or a skill, maybe is the right word, practice is your imagination. Like how can I envision what this would have been like at the time that this track or sign, you know, whatever it is, in this case a mound of a sort of a tubish mound of vole scats, like what would need to be here? And then I suppose if you start to imagine the snow in the wintertime and you're like, oh, these guys have runs under the snow
mm-hmm.
and then this is their sort of latrine area, and they just push the stuff in there, and of course it doesn't, like, it just gets packed in under the snow.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, is that something that like how does that I mean, does that work pretty generally, like you try and imagine you know what it takes to for, well, like we saw a bear bite marks on a tree, for mm-hmm. example, like how is it that happens, and trying to kind of reconstruct in your mind, I guess, this image of like what happened.
Yeah, I think imagination is definitely a useful skill in those sorts of situations, and can kind of help you piece together a story or get ideas. And, you know, mm-hmm. you may not always be right, you know, but, you know, as you gather more evidence, or, you know, you may think about like, okay, well, I've developed this theory, like I imagine that this vole scat is here from during the snow, like what kind of evidence might support or reject that idea. And so you may think about like, oh, well, like if that were the case, like these scats would all be kind of old because it's all melted away. Like, do I find any fresh vole scats that are like that? Because that would, you know, mean that probably wasn't that situation, or, you know, that sort of thing. You can use that to generate ideas and then look for corroborating evidence. And also, like, I think, you know, another tool is you just hold the questions and be like, okay, I don't know what that is, I don't know why it's there, but I'm just gonna, you know, keep it in mind, and maybe someday I'll figure it out. And that, you know, I've had questions that years later, like, oh, somebody released this insect track and sign book, let me dig through for this weird insecty thing I found and see if it's in there. And sure enough, there it is. I'm like, oh, finally, like, figured out what this one thing is I found in the desert, you know, or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. And there's other questions I have that, you know, I haven't figured out yet. And sometimes it's like just really basic stuff, like, I mean, basic once you know it, but, you know, before I really started learning tracks, I was still interested in them. And like, I remember probably in high school or college and went over to Shelikof, and, you know, they do have nice sand beaches over there. And so I took a whole bunch of pictures of tracks and sign and stuff, and like, you know, I knew what deer tracks were and I knew what bear tracks were, but there were other things there too that, like at the time, just like I had no idea what they were. And then after like a year of learning more tracking stuff, you know, several years later, I'm like, oh yeah, that's really obvious. Like that's a mink, you know,
yeah.
or that's an otter or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like once you know what it is, like it's like, yeah. oh, and it's fun to go back through your old pictures, or, you know, some people like to do journals and drawings
yeah,
and
yeah.
stuff like that. I mostly do take pictures of stuff when I'm trying to save the memory in some more rigorous way, I guess. And so, yeah, it's fun to go back through there and see, like, oh, I have learned some stuff.
Yeah.
And, like, this is pretty obvious now that, you know, a few years ago was just a complete mystery.
That is, I mean, that's one of the, I guess, the dangers, I suppose, of getting into natural history, nature study stuff, because there's always this unknown that's out there. You're never mm-hmm. going to exhaust, what there is to be known. And so you can end up at times feeling a little discouraged because you're like, man, I don't know anything. All this stuff I still don't know. And so it is, like you were saying, it's encouraging. I have my old weblog posts that I look at and I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. I didn't used to know what that is. And now I know what it is. Or sometimes, in that post, I just say, I don't know what it was, or I have a picture and I don't have the name, like unidentified plant or something. And, mm-hmm. and now I'm like, oh, I know exactly what that is. And so it is a nice way to kind of remind yourself of your progress. And I guess that's one of the things. So we've talked a little bit about just kind of the types of tracks and sign, and no doubt there are many more. I mean, any sort of evidence, and it doesn't have to be just mammals, evidence of other things, birds and physical environment, weather, mm-hmm. all those kind of things. And the long-term geology is kind of another sort of tracking exercise.
Yeah, I mean, you can, like, people in the community that I learned tracking and talk about all kinds of different, like, you know, like you're saying, tracking the weather or geology, or like people even talk about it sort of as tracking themselves, mm-hmm. inner tracking or whatever they call it, where they're just kind of tracking their moods and stuff like that, you know, sort of a different field, but sort of some of the same principles apply. And like, I have a friend that's like a really great tracker, and he just voraciously studies everything, and like he looks up journals on, like, you know, the California pest management or whatever, and reads about the different bark beetles and fungus and stuff that can infect the trees up there. And and so, you know, there's, you can go as deep as you want, you know. I actually kind of like the I mean, it's nice to feel like I know some of the stuff I'm looking at, but I also like the mystery of, like, yeah. there's always more to learn, because that's, for me, that's part of the fun is sort of figuring things out and discovery and that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there's a book called Tracking, or The Art of Tracking, Origins of Science, I think is what it's called.
Mm-hmm. Louis Liebenberg.
Yeah, and so he worked with the San Bushmen in the Kalahari for many, and I think he still does, actually. And you know, and it was just like you described, you know, that's the scientific method. You know, you have a hypothesis, you ask questions, you look at the evidence, and there are these patterns that emerge, and understanding these patterns and asking those questions. And so the questions about it, it's not, I think a lot of people are just like, oh, well, what's this track? And that's a very, like, that's the first question, I suppose, at some mm-hmm. level. It's like, who did this? And that may or may not be easy, but to determine. In many cases around here, you know, it's pretty clear it's a bear or it's a deer.
Right.
You know?
For larger mammals, it's up here. There's a pretty, or in Sitka in particular, yeah. there's a pretty limited pool of options.
Set. Yeah. In some locations, you might have trouble with deer versus goat, but in most locations, it's a deer, you know, yeah, if you see the hoof prints. But then another question is a slightly deeper question about who is male or female, young mm-hmm. or old, you know, mm-hmm. and those kind of questions. But it goes, and then, you know, what, you know, these, all these who and WH questions, I guess, you know, what was happening here? Were they moving fast or slow? And you start to, and I guess this is, you know, a level that I've heard about and read about, but not really, you know, except in the most obvious of cases, not really tried to sort of explore myself, at least with, you know, footprint type tracks. It's, mm-hmm. it's like, you know, how much can you determine from this set of tracks in the sand? And some people seem to, like, develop an ability to determine an amazing amount of information from a set of tracks about, you know, the who and the what was going on. And mm-hmm. and so there's just a variety of ways. Not only there's an immense amount of breadth as well as depth
yeah.
that you can explore, it seems like. And And I know that you've kind of gone a little further than I have. And part of that is like, it's easier. I mean, this is tracking is, I think it attracts a lot of people in some respects that like to spend time alone in the woods. Mm-hmm. There's value in that. But it's also very useful, as you were saying at the beginning, to learn with people. And yeah. So having these kind of communities of trackers that even if they go out on their own, sometimes you come back and you discuss, or you go out and you look together. And
yeah, and all the main tracking programs I've done were usually like meet once a month and stuff for the weekend. Yeah. And so that's, you know, sort of a great mix of that, of like, okay, we're going out together with people that are interested in this and learn intensively for a weekend. And then, you know, the rest of the month we can kind of do our own study and get out and read books and that sort of thing. So,
yeah. And it's, you know, around here, like you mentioned before, there's not that much sand. You can get out on some beaches. Cruise Off has some really nice beaches. And, mm-hmm. and you did a little, you know, trekking workshop thing a few years ago here and got a chance. And I remember one of the things that you commented on was how many mouse tracks there were at the upper part of the beach, just
really
under the
neat.
Drip line.
Yeah.
And I would have had no idea. I mean, I know there are mice around, but you don't actually see them very often.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of that under there, and so you get this chance to learn and understand about things that you aren't there to see, like mm-hmm. the what's there. You can't see everything all the time, but the tracks that are left, you can infer based on them, and you know, learn what's happening at night, for example.
Yeah.
And start to understand the animals that are doing that. But it is difficult without the sand. And so do you have any like suggestions? So folks that are just walking on trails around here, you know, if they're interested in just kind of thinking a little bit more, just having that be at the edge of their awareness and maybe is an increasing part of their awareness as they're out in the natural world around here. Like, do you have suggestions for what people might kind of try and pay more attention to as they're sort of out on their wanders?
Sure. So, you know, if you're to start out with, I guess we can talk about just tracks in particular or, mm-hmm. or, like scat, you know, you can always look out for weird looking poop on the trail or something, you know, and it's good to sort of get used to sort of the common culprits of like, oh, if you don't know what deer poop looks like in different seasons, because, you know, it looks different depending on what they've been eating and that sort of thing. So once you learn what that looks like, then it's easier to look at something and be like, wait a second, that's not deer poop. Like, what is that? And so you can kind of see what stands out as different than sort of the normal things. Same for tracks. Like if you know what a deer track looks like, if you know what a bear track looks like, if you're on the trail, it's really useful to also know what dog tracks look like, because that's what you're going to see a lot if you're on a hiking trail. So if you can pick out what's different, then, or you can kind of eliminate that. Or actually, I have friends who are really into tracking dogs and likes to figure out like what different species, you know,
or have, different breed of
species, but different breeds of dogs have different kind of tracks, and you can kind of study that. And most people that I know into tracking aren't really into that, but some of the people I know are and like really like that. So if that's your thing, you can do that too. And so like there's often mud patches along the trail. Like Connor saw a bear track on right in the middle of the trail when we were hiking up the trail. And I think a couple of the tracks had been kind of trampled on by people and dogs, but one of them was nice there. And so if you kind of keep an eye out for that and just kind of look at things as you're going by, or often if you're going over a creek or something, you can look down and if there's a mud patch, like I'll just like sit there for a minute and look and see if I see anything in there. Or if I'm out in the muskeg, like often you may see like bird tracks and some of the mud puddles there, or like a weasel, or, you know, in any kind of small critter out there can, or big critters can make tracks along there. So sort of track traps, people call them, where places where it's easy to see the tracks and you can just kind of pay attention to there as you're getting started. The snow is also great up here. I remember, you know, when we were probably like high school or college age, and you and I went out hiking in the snow, and we came across like some otter trails and just followed them around most of the afternoon, I think, and That was really fun. It was easy to follow them in the open and just kind of fun to see their behavior of them loping along and then sliding and loping along and sliding and, you know, going from water source to water source and stuff. And there were patches where it was harder to, like in the woods, harder to follow the trail because the snow was mostly gone there. But you could be like, well, it's moving that direction and just keep going and seeing if you can find it again or whatever. And just, you know, look for things that are there and like have fun with it, you know.
See what sort of questions come to mind. I mean, like, yeah. So like I suppose the obvious one that like is, well, what, and that in mm-hmm. some ways, but don't stop there. Like what else comes to mind that mm-hmm. you might be curious about?
Yeah. And you know, questions are great. It doesn't always have to be about questions like mm-hmm. that situation. Like I thought it was just fun to follow an otter around yeah. and see what it was doing, you know,
yeah.
and just like sort of imagine the, like, because I like watching animals, and so like I can kind of imagine by seeing the trail and seeing the slides and stuff like that, I can kind of in my head imagine what it might have been doing. And that's, you know, not as good maybe as watching it directly, but it's you know, I don't get to see otters running around and sliding around all the time, but in the wintertime it's not it's easier to find evidence of that, and that's still really fun to me. Another thing that I would suggest is like to just try and be aware of things in general that stand out as being like, what is that? Like, so an example is, you know, if you're out in the muskegs or grassy meadows and stuff, like voles make nests out of grass. And so, you know, if you're out there, you might find like a big wadge of grass that's all, you know, not attached to anything and just like in a big mound. And if you see that and didn't know what it was and you're like, well, that's weird, you know, and go investigate and like pull it apart and see, like, you know, if you're really lucky and the vole was really unlucky, there might be a vole in there.
Yeah.
But even if there wasn't, you know, that you may find like a little impression inside, like a little, you know, space in there. And there's often like scat in there or fresher clippings of grass or things like that. Just like look for things that seem out of place or interesting that you're not really sure how to explain, and see what you can figure out about it. Just kind of explore it and keep those questions in your mind. And if you can figure out theories for it, that's great. And if you can't, like I was saying earlier, just like hold that question in your mind and see if you can find out more about it. Another idea is if you have access to a tracking field guide or just an animal field guide or whatever, like you can, like I like browsing through those. There's a lot of interesting pictures and interesting information, and it can give you ideas of like, oh yeah, they talk about this deer rub stuff. Like I've never seen that before. Like maybe I should look out for it or the vole nest or, you know, all kinds of different signs and behaviors that, you know, if you don't know to look for them, they're hard to see. But if you know to look for them, then sometimes you find them, and that's a neat thing to do as well.
Yeah, you know, in terms of the books, I was just thinking, I don't know that there's a little booklet, I suppose. It's not really a big booklet, a big book, but a little booklet of tracks put out, I think, by Discovery Southeast. It was by Richard Carstensen, maybe with some help, but he's the author I remember. Just of animal tracks, mostly mm-hmm. animal tracks, you know. But there's not really anything else that I can think of that is specific for Southeast Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely there's tracks and sign in the Pacific Northwest, I think. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact title, but David Moskowitz has.
And so there'll be overlap with there. Mm-hmm. And as we talked about before, you know, Sitka specifically doesn't have an especially rich diversity of mammals, which is good and bad. It makes it easier to identify things, but it, you know, at a certain point probably makes it a little less interesting if you're really into mammals. You know, the mainland certainly has a lot more diversity of mammal species, both large and small. But there are you know, Mammals of North America tracking books. Mm-hmm. But beyond the mammals, and I think a lot of people, when they think of tracking initially, are thinking of like, oh, well, I'm going to follow a deer trail or something mm-hmm. like that. And trailing is a particular, like, so that's what we did with the otters. We essentially tried to follow them around. Yeah. And that is one, you know, skill of tracking, but it isn't the only one by any means.
Right.
But there's been some pretty interesting books in, I don't know, I guess some of them have been around for quite a while now, but Bird Tracks and Sign of North America, which of course has a lot of stuff that isn't going to show up here, but it also gives you ideas of, oh, look, I saw something look sort of similar to this around here. And, you know, what species do we have here?
Right.
So sapsuckers being a good example of bird species that leaves a lot of sign that sticks around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting, you know, to notice that and notice patterns around that sometimes, like different species of trees and that they're utilizing versus others. And then also another one that for me has been pretty interesting recently is Insect Tracks and Sign.
Yeah, that's a really neat book.
That's a good book. And insects leave an immense diversity of tracks and sign. I was just walking up Indian River Trail. I don't know, I guess it's been a couple of weeks ago now, and there was a cedar tree, and of course cedar trees stick around for a long time. It was dead. It had probably been dead for a few years. The bark was all off.
Mm-hmm.
The side branches were still on. But there was all these really intricate little you know, like engravings almost in the wood of the trunk. And those were all from different beetles.
Yeah.
And the immature, the larvae of the beetle, you know, carve out. And I guess, as I understand it, in some cases at least, you can identify the beetle species based on the sort of qualitative characteristics of
I was mentioned earlier, like he's really good at, like, he's learned how to do that, and like mm-hmm. you can look at it like, oh yeah, that's the such and such bark beetle or whatever, you can tell because you know, different characteristics. And I haven't really learned that myself, but it's definitely something you can learn and very interesting. And they're like, it's neat to just look at them and think about, like until other people told me, I hadn't really, you know, I looked at them and thought, that's kind of cool. You know, and I remember one time in college, you know, we're on some science retreat or something, and some of us were looking at a stick covered. I'm like, oh, maybe they're alien, you know, inscriptions or whatever, just kind of joking around. But you can kind of look at it and kind of piece together some of the puzzle yourself, as far as, you know, maybe not exactly what figuring out what species it is without doing more sort of book research. But you can see a lot of times where, like, the egg was laid, like where the adult burrowed in and then the eggs were laid, and then the little tubes sort of thing going off from there, and they gradually get bigger as the larva, you know, grow. And so that sort of thing that, you know, I hadn't known to look for, but if you look for it, it's there, and kind of neat to see that.
Yeah, those are, I mean, they have such a variety of kind of patterns, designs. I don't know how you really want to what the right word is there, but there's an aesthetic satisfaction in just like appreciating the sort of the beauty of them, I guess, is maybe the way to put it. And, you know, even beyond knowing, like it isn't always about being able to put a name on everything. For me, it's nice to get names, but I understand I'm not going to get a name for everything I see here. I also, so I'm pretty satisfied. I like, I prefer to get a name, but I'm pretty satisfied just learning to recognize, oh, this is, I've seen these like this before.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, I've learned over the years that, that an initial, thought, or that it may be that I don't, like, initially I can't distinguish between, like, two bird species look very much alike to me, mm-hmm. or, you know, two sets of track or sign look very similar. But as you gain experience and sort of discriminating, awareness, you become able to distinguish more and more subtlety in the differences. And that's kind of a satisfying experience for me about it. You know, for people that are new, it can be like, if somebody comes along and they're like seeing all these things and they all look the same, it can be a little frustrating.
Yeah,
I think.
It can be a little overwhelming when you're.
But you don't. It's fine to just appreciate stuff, kind of without, you know, oh, that's some sort of an insect there. The other one that I've really been kind of trying to pay attention to this last year, like, I can't remember when I first noticed like consciously noticed leaf miners. And so leaf miners usually are flies or moths. Occasionally, I think maybe there's some beetles that do it, but usually the larva of a fly or a moth. And what they do is the eggs, I think, are usually laid on the surface, but maybe sometimes they're injected. I'm not sure. But then they actually live inside between the top and the bottom layer of the leaf, and they mine out the leaf, and that's how they live. And I suppose it's a safer place. You know, it's harder for them to get eaten there. But they different kind of miners leave different kind of patterns. And actually, one of the co-authors on the insect tracks and sign of North America is working on a book on leaf miners.
Oh, yeah.
The leaf miners of North America. And so he is on bugguide.net. And so I post my pictures there. And like there's, you know, there's been two or three different species. You know, I know what the plant is and I find a leaf mine in it. So I'll, especially if the larva's in it, I'll take it home and try and raise it up. And so he said for two or three different ones that I've collected, he's like, oh, well, we don't, there's no actual record of that species of plant having any miners. And, you know, in the cases that I found, it was generally West Coast species that are only found on the West Coast. And, you know, leaf mines are kind of a little obscure.
Yeah,
I mean, they're easy
not
to find.
The hottest it's, topic of research.
No. And so I'm sure that there's not been a lot of looking. There's been more looking on the East Coast, but he lives on the East Coast, and he said in his yard he's found new species. It's just not a. But the beauty of it is they're really easy to find when you start to look. I think in the past I was like, oh, somebody stepped on that leaf and that's how it got damaged,
or just like rotting for some reason or whatever.
Exactly.
You know?
And now that I've started to pay attention, I'm noticing more and more things. It's like different species and noticing patterns. Like dogwood has a kind of has a leaf miner. And most of the mines, what I noticed, like the first couple of years, I would always notice them in the fall. And of course there was nothing left except the mine itself. And so I had nothing that I could try and raise or anything. So every year I'm like, oh, I got to notice them earlier this year. So it's been fun for me to just kind of go and explore that and like see a leaf and I'll just pick it up and pick it and hold it up to the light and kind of look through and see if it looks like there's a larva in there. And if there is, I'll put it in a little collection container and take it home. And a few of them, at least, I've been able to raise up to adults and will hopefully send off, and maybe someday they'll be identified. I don't know. But, you know, the fun is just kind of like, well, how many different plants are getting mined?
Yeah. And, you know, as far as you know, is it usually just like one species will mine, or one species of insect will mine a particular species of plant, or will there potentially be several kind of insects that might mine
I think that there certainly are specialists. I think there are some, like, for example, there's the spear scale or atriplex that grows along the beach, and that's frequently mined. And so those mines are done by a fly of some sort, and it's in a genus, and I don't know what the species of the fly is. The other, and there may be some other things. The other thing that happens is that often these are parasitized, so you'll end up getting a wasp out. Cow parsnip is another thing that has a fly that mines it. And I think the first ones of those, I found a bunch of, I think you might have been with me, and they're the pupa were little black things that look like little horns. And they were the fly pupa. And we found those on the surface of the leaf. And it turned out like the first things that came out were little wasps, like little tiny wasps. And I can't remember if I ended up getting any actual flies out of those, but sometimes they're all parasitized. And so it is like there's this whole world of insect stuff going on where parasites and, you know, parasites on the parasites sometimes.
Yeah, some of the wasps are pretty nasty as far as like what they do to the species they're parasitized. And yeah, it's kind of horrifying sometimes to read about some of that. But
unsettling, yeah. Yeah, there's definitely some things there. I found a spider when I was taking a picture of a spider, and I was like, and there was a little tiny yellow thing attached to it. So I took it home and was like raising the spider, kept going, but this yellow thing was there and it would kind of pulse a little bit sometimes. And then one day I went in there and the spider was gone and there was a wasp. And so, I mean, it had been a wasp larva that was that was attached and probably feeding. And then at some point, it just like consumed the whole spider. Mm-hmm. And then I mean, I wasn't looking every day, so it probably had been over a period of days that it done that, gone into its, pupal form, and then metamorphosed into the adult form. It's definitely, the leaf mine things. It seems like there are specialists. I think there's not that much diversity of leaf mines here. I noticed this year some of the leaf mines I collected were, I guess they're chironomid midges. So chironomids are a very common kind of midge. There's a lot of diversity there. They're hard to identify, as I understand it. Associated with water, mm-hmm. a lot of times. The larvae are generally aquatic, but apparently there's some that are leaf miners. And so like in deer cabbage, and then I found some in the shooting star leaves. I found some in fringed grass of Parnassus leaves, but I don't know if they're all the same species. That was just kind of a generalist leaf miner, and could go to, and each of those kind of have fairly fleshy leaves. Mm-hmm. Fairly thick leaves, and they grow near wet places.
Yeah, wetlands.
So,
yeah.
I don't know what those guys are doing in the wintertime. How are they? So there's all these questions that come out. It's like, just from these little leaf mines. And so I don't know, I think at least two of those species, the deer cabbage, hadn't had any prior records of leaf mining. Hmm. And there may be some other things leaf mining the deer cabbage, but I haven't really, I only first noticed the deer cabbage mines this year. Specifically. So, I don't have a good answer for that. I think some of both. Like there are definitely that when I posted the picture of the ground dogwood with leaf mines, Charlie Eisman, I think his name is.
That sounds about right.
Like that. He said that there's a ground dogwood, a bunchberry specialist leaf miner, and its last name is associated with the species name is kind of indicates that fact. He's never been able to raise one to adulthood, like they never have emerged as adults, but but that's what's known from those, and they have a certain style of mine. It isn't clear whether that's the only thing there or not, but it's kind of just. And it's not hard in a lot of these, in the insect world especially, to get into things where you're discovering new stuff essentially. Mm-hmm. Like nobody else has ever done that, and if that sort of floats your boat, it's kind of fun, right? It's not that big of a deal, but it's kind of fun.
I mean,
anyway.
And some of the neat stuff about that is like you can, like you were saying, you can find it everywhere. So that's fun. Like if you're looking for, mammals, like we were saying earlier around here, like it's harder to find tracks of things that aren't deer or, bear if you look in the right places or whatever. But that stuff, like there's plants everywhere and there, like it's really common.
Anytime.
If you're interested.
Anytime. And, certainly the season matters. And I also enjoy the sort of winter. It's not really tracking per se. In some ways, it's like the remains of plants, mm-hmm. So it's like it's kind of a track. I mean, it's if we think about tracks kind of as this general, it's what remains of the organism after it's kind of moved on. It's like just the stems sticking up out of the snow, or it's like, what plant is that? It's like
also
super common.
Like looking at the sort of the seeds of plants, and you can like looking in scat, you can look at like, oh, that bear has been eating a lot of plant seeds. Like what was that? Like, a lot of times it'll be like salmonberry, but there are also often other things that, it's like, oh, what?
Well, I remember the trip up the Middle Sister we mentioned earlier. There was the kind of the hellebore, or corn lily is the name I like to use for it, but Veratrum viridi, and it's highly poisonous for extremely poisonous for humans. And yet I remember you were noticing
it was browsed a lot, actually.
And it seems like we even saw some scat, like bear scat had seeds in it. Which was like, okay, so what's going on here? Clearly something's different enough in the physiology that it's not killing these animals, presumably. Yeah. But
like deer and bear both will eat skunk cabbage, which I wouldn't recommend at all.
No, yes. And so, the little diggings there. Skunk cabbage is a funny one because it's not actually poisonous.
Yeah.
It's a actual physical issue of like it, the little microcrystals shred your tissues. And I like, it's like, what are deer tissue? What's deer tissue made of?
Why is that different? Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Like somehow they have a titanium cell wall, you know, they don't have cell walls cause they're not, you know, cause they're animals. But yeah, it is kind of interesting to think about like what allows them to do that. So, it's another way of interacting. You know, a lot of people, like you were saying, it's fun to watch the animals, mm-hmm. but the animals aren't always there.
Yeah.
But you can almost always find sign of some sort, you know, either the sort of short lasting sign around here. It's so wet. A lot of times the rain will wash stuff away, but the longer term sign is still there. You know, the habitual patterns, the feeding sign on shrubs. And that's one of the things that's been interesting to me. You know, when I'm wandering around, is looking at the pattern of deer browse. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, there's this bush that's just like nubs.
Yeah.
And then 3 feet away, there's another bush that looks, I mean, it's the same kind. It seems like it would be good. Barely touched.
Yeah.
Like, is it just that they're that lazy and they don't want to take 3 steps over? Or, you know, because maybe they're just browsing as they walk by? Or is there a different flavor? You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But just these little questions that come up and are still available to us, even in our relatively difficult tracking conditions in terms of, like, we don't have the nice wet sand where everything is a perfect impression.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I mean, you can get, like, if you're hiking down the trail or whatever, like, some places you can see, like, everything's, like, heavily browsed. Like, wow, the deer must just really like to hang out in here and eat the blueberry bushes and stuff because, like, they're all just, like, coppice down to nothing just about, you know, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. So
yeah, it makes you wonder, like, I mean, to me that sort of thing is, it raises a question of like why, you know.
Yeah.
and that's probably, you know, they browse on woody stuff in the winter, mm-hmm. Mostly in the summer they mostly eat leaves and things. And so that makes me, well, it's probably a prime wintering habitat then, you know? And then it's like, what about the geography here? And I guess that's the other part that's fun for me, is the way that kind of paying attention to some of these things can draw your awareness out into the kind of space and time a little more widely than just like the little pocket in front of you. So, well, we're kind of wrapping up or winding down time-wise here. I was wondering, is there anything else you'd like to sort of suggest or leave people with as we close out here?
Nothing particular comes to mind. Just, I guess, go out there and have some fun and, like, just question stuff as that you see it. Like, just keep it in your mind and see what you can come up with, you know, and have some mysteries. Enjoy the mysteries out there.
Enjoy the mysteries out there. That sounds good. And I guess, well, I should ask you, what's your favorite track, for a silly question?
My favorite track?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I mean, it's all kind of context, I guess. Like, you know, if I'm out, you know, tracking areas where there's wolves and stuff, like, it's really fun to find those because I'm still, like, it's not something I get to see very often. And so that's pretty cool. Or, you know, like, finding bear tracks around here is really neat because it's like big, you know, charismatic animals.
Yeah.
That, so.
Yeah. I don't know that I have a favorite track, but it is, it's always kind of cool to see the little tiny tracks. It's like when you happen to find a shrew track or something like that.
It can be really fun too. So.
So, well, I appreciate you coming in and visiting with me here on your trip up here this year. And, you know, I know we've had you on the show at least maybe once or twice before.
I think,
So, and I think we talked about your summer experiences that year. So,
yeah,
it's been good to talk about tracks, and hopefully, folks out there are get the opportunity to just, you know, pay a little more attention when you're out and think about, you know, these questions. You know, enjoy the mystery. What is it that's been out here before me? You know, what's it been doing? And what can I learn from that? So, appreciate you coming in and
thanks for having me.
Speaking with me for the show. And just want to remind folks, thanks again for joining me this week. This has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show and with my brother Jonathan here. And I'll be back in a couple of weeks as we head further into August. I'm sure by then we'll be more into the fall migration. I guess summer doesn't officially end until the third week of September, but around here, it's definitely feeling like the summer is winding down. Definitely things starting to die back a little bit, And so, yeah, we'll look forward to what the season brings. And as always, want to thank folks that are taking the time to observe things and share those observations. I love to hear about what folks are seeing. And so you can share on the Sitka Birds email list or go to Facebook and join the Sitka Birds email list there if you've got some bird observations. Otherwise, you can like the Sitka Nature page on Facebook, share observations there, or send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com. I'd love to hear about what you're seeing, help answer any questions if I can, or just hear your story. So this has been Matt, Sitka Nature Show, KCW, Sitka.